When I asked after our meeting last year who might be someone we would have as our speaker, our keynote this year, there was a groundswell toward Father Basil Cole, who I was, I didn't really know Father Basil. I made what was probably the tactical error of Googling him and then became totally overwhelmed at the idea of introducing him because, really, he has a very extensive history of serving the church and religious life. But he helped me enormously. Last night we had a mass for a handful of sisters who had not been able to get mass because of their travel. And Father began his homily saying, "We don't say, Lord, have justice on me. We say, Lord, have mercy on me." So I'm saying I could never do Father's bio justice. So I ask your mercy in trying to present who he is as a person, as God's mercy. But truly, Father joined the Dominicans in 1960. He studied in France for his licentiate, at the Angelicum for his doctoral studies, where he would later teach. He's served as teacher, as parish priest, as author. I want to say in the Dominican tradition, he has served as a preacher in the best and fullest sense of the word. And particularly, I think, we know in him, somewhat through his writing, through the communities, different communities' experience, his profound understanding of religious life, and I'm sure his profound experiential living of religious life. But I did not want to introduce him purely from what I gained on paper, so I called, last night I thought I would call one of our theologians who might have crossed paths with Father. She was unavailable. So I called one of our sisters who had lived in the D.C. area for a long time, who's now living on the campus of the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, and I just asked her if she had ever met Father and what she would know, and she said, "I never met him. What I know is that everybody loves him." So I'm sure Father would rather be listened to, heard, understood, and have what he shares lived out than just to be loved by a lot of religious women. But I think both things might happen in the next 2 days. So, Father, thank you.
Is this working? It's on? Your thing is on. Okay. Oh, geez. It's easier for me to talk to priests than for sisters. I have no problem with priests, but sisters, I get... you have an ability to see through me, I guess. Anyway, you all have blue and white and black and gray and all these different colors from different institutes, and yet you have more in common than you have distinct. You're distinct, yes, different charisms, maybe not gravely different, but certainly different, and yet the same ultimate goals and the same ultimate means with nuances here and there. And so it's, I hope that I can speak in such a fashion that it touches everybody's institutes and not just, a particular one. I mean, I'm not trying to make you all one Dominican sisters. I'd be thrown out anyway. But still, it's very, very wonderful to see this wonderful group of people who believe in Jesus and who love Jesus. Where to begin? Well, I think the best place to begin to talk about obedience is to go back to Socrates. Let's just put aside for the moment our Catholic faith, our belief in God, our belief in the Lord Jesus, etc., and just look at obedience almost purely from the natural point of view. And that way we can kind of understand a little more theologically of what obedience is about. And so I chose a couple of authors, Aristotle and Socrates, to simply start our reflection here on the whole issue theologically of obedience, which is a moral virtue, that cascades into many other virtues. It's a natural virtue, important for society, and as we understand its naturalness, then we can understand how grace elevates it to something even deeper than the natural. Before you were consecrated, you were baptized and confirmed and consecrated by those two sacraments. And you are, as St. Paul would say, you are a new creation. Now let's take a look at the old creation a little bit, abstracting from this. In 399 BC, an Athenian jury found Socrates guilty of impiety and corrupting the morals of the youth, for which crimes the jury condemned him to death. According to Plato's account, Socrates' friends arranged his escape, but he chose to stay and drink the fatal hemlock, which of course was wrong for him to do, but that's another problem. Arguing that to defy the judgment against him would break his agreements and commitments and to mistreat his friends, his countries, and the laws of Athens. The laws of Athens, keep that in mind. You find that in the Crito on the trial and death. Socrates' arguments are sketchy. And Crito, his interlocutor, does little to challenge him, but they're nevertheless suggestive of the theories of the obligations of a citizen. They merged in the 2.5 millennia since his death, obeying laws. There are four categories of trying to explain a little bit of why you should obey laws. Socrates maintains that his long residence in Athens shows that he had entered into an agreement with its laws and committed himself to obey them, an argument that anticipates the social contract or consent theory of political obligation. Secondly, he acknowledges that he owes his birth, nurture, and education, among other goods, to the laws of Athens. And he hints that with gratitude that he can't wrong them by disobeying their laws. He appeals to what is now known as the argument from fairness when he suggests that disobedience would be a kind of mistreatment of his fellow citizens. And so he asks Crito, if we leave here without the city's permission, because they want to get him escaped. He says, are we mistreating people whom we should least mistreat? I mean, he also speaks just from the point of view of utilitarianism. Do you think it possible for a city not to be destroyed if the verdicts of its courts have no force, but are nullified and set at naught by private individuals? He doesn't develop any of these arguments as to why you should obey the laws of the land, but he gives basically four options there that have been developed over the centuries and especially in today's modern world of philosophical thought on obeying civil law. Let's turn to Aristotle. Aristotle has something very interesting to say, which, again, on the purely natural level, helps us understand obedience to law. Aristotle taught that the corruption of the state begins where? At home. When the child does not learn virtue, Politics, Book 4. Likewise, familial piety guides husbands and wives, parents and children in their personal relations. Considerateness means trying to control tempers, speaking in normal terms, avoiding belittling remarks, ridicule, and all the rest of it. Care for one's personal appearance, all that goes into a household. The husband is the governor of the home, not as a brute or a weakling, but does his best to protect his wife, children, support them, guide them, handle wisely the family property and finances. From that little nugget there, that the child, if he doesn't learn virtue in the household, comes the corruption of the state. You can see it happening everywhere, everywhere. Now, from the politics of Aristotle, we get some more insights to help us appreciate this virtue. He says that, this is found in Book 1, every state is a community of some kind. The social teaching of the church talks a great deal about the socialness of the human person, that we're created consocial in a way. We'll explain why later, I hope, unless my memory collapses. And every community is established with a view to some good. Every community is established for some good. Those of us in the consecrated life, we're not interested in some good. We're interested in the supernatural goodness of God, aren't we? For mankind always acts in order to obtain that which they think good. Talk a little about fundamental inclinations shortly, I hope. But if all communities aim at some good, he says, the state or political community, which is the highest of all and which embraces all the rest, aims at good in a greater degree than any other, and at the highest good. And for Aristotle, if you remember your Aristotle, for him the highest good is to be able to contemplate the good. Done by very few people on earth to do such a thing. The family is the association established by nature to supply for men's everyday wants, and members of it are called companions of the cupboard. And by F. Epimenides the Cretan, companions of the manger. But when several families are united, and the association aims at something more than the supply of daily needs, the first society to be formed is the village. And the most natural form of a village appears to be that of a colony, from the families composed of children, grandchildren, who are said to be suckled with the same milk. And this is the reason why Hellenic states were originally governed by kings, because the Hellenes were under royal rule before they came together, as the barbarians still are. Every family is ruled by the eldest, and therefore in the colonies of the family, the kingly form of government prevailed, because they were of the same blood. As Homer says, each one gives law to his children and to his wives, for they lived dispersedly, as was the manner of ancient times. You can see where he's going with this. There has to be authority, has to be goals, and somebody has to kind of organize, plot out how to take care of the common good of these families, called the colony and then the state. When several villages are united in a single complete community, large enough to be nearly or quite self-sufficing, the state comes into existence, originating in the bare needs of life and the continuing in existence for the sake of the good life. And those of you that remember your philosophy, you remember the good life is the life of virtue. And the virtuous life he expounds at great length in his Ethics. St. Thomas comments further on those things in the Ethics. And you will recall that the life of virtue is really meant to stimulate and develop love for the truth, love for contemplating the truth. Each of the virtues come down to the what are called cardinal virtues, hinge virtues, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. When we say that somebody's unhinged, quite often we mean they're not having a virtuous moment, are they? And I suppose when you deal with novices, as I have dealt with them for 3 years, they get unhinged now and again. Thank God I wasn't the novice master. I was the prior. Ooh. And therefore, if the earlier forms of society are natural, so's the state. For it is the end of them. And the nature of the thing is its end. For what such thing is when fully developed, we call its nature. Whether we're speaking of a man, a horse, or a family. Besides, the final cause and end of a thing is the best cause. And to be self-sufficient is the end and the best, self-sufficing. Besides, the final cause and the end of a thing is the best, and hence it's evident that the state is a creation of nature. And that man is by nature a political animal. And he who by nature and not by mere accident is without a state is either a bad man or above humanity. He is like the tribeless, lawless, heartless one, whom Homer denounces. The natural outcast is forthwith lover of war. He may be compared to an isolated piece at draughts, which was a form of checkers as far as I know. Now, that man is more of a political animal than bees or any other gregarious animals is evident. Nature, as we often say, makes nothing in vain, and man is the only animal whom she has endowed with the gift of speech. And he goes on for 4 or 5 or 6 books along those lines. And so we can see that on the purely natural level, human nature needs authority, someone who's got the power to make laws. Authority isn't for authority's sake. Power isn't for power's sake. And laws are not for law's sake. They coalesce, don't they, into helping incomplete human beings achieve common goods. The common good, we'd say abstractly. What's the common good on the purely natural level? Well, the goal, of course, but also the means to the goal. And what are the means to the goal on the natural level? Well, you already know it. Safety, food and drink, a household, roof over your head, warmth, ability to work and gain foodstuffs, and perhaps even gain money to buy things, but also to intermingle and communicate with one another. That's why human beings have speech, so we can talk about things, communicate things. But also, since we're thinkers, we need to also have some people formulate guidelines, limits, so that we don't violate one another's rights. The right to life, the right to certain freedoms. Of course, that's going to vary from century to century, from state to state. There's going to be natural rights, and there's going to be what we would call human rights, in part given to us by the societies that we may happen to live in. The most fundamental right that seems to cover practically every civilization is the right to innocent human life, at least in theory, though murders take place, robberies take place. That's why we need a police and army. Safety. That's when things catch on fire, we need somebody to take care of the fire. Firemen, fire persons, all the rest of it. All of these things, purely natural. And so as we live in harmony, obeying certain laws of the household at home, from the pater familias, as the Romans called the father of the family, and the mater familias, who also organized the family home, children learn to grow in certain natural perfection, to grow in a natural, organized sort of a way, being harmonious and helpful, and eventually become adults and then take their place, helping others and themselves, achieving the common good, principally through marriage, their work, family life. St. Thomas Aquinas reminds us in the Summa, and the several councils of the Church, I believe, remind us that we can all have natural virtue without grace, but it's going to be very, 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 very imperfect. You can't remain completely intact with virtue. You can eventually people fall away from virtue, and then they sometimes pick themselves out, or they just get worse. And that becomes, in part, the distinction that the Church makes between sins of weakness and sins of malice. And Aristotle and company didn't think in those terms so much. That comes later in with a theological perspective. The country's laws are very, very important because there's a certain spirit among some who basically believe in anarchy, a freedom without limits, or we might say better, a liberty without limits. If we define freedom as that which produces within the human person, strength and self-possession and the ability to accomplish a lot of goods. Liberty is just being able to choose, period. And as you know, with the abortion people, you know, everything is choice, 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 you know, as if that's a perfection. Well, what counts is, what are you choosing? What's the bonum? Is there a real good being chosen? Or is it an apparent good, an illusory good, defective good? So, let's again use our philosophical heads and try to understand a little bit more about human nature so that we can understand the role of law a little more and understand the role of authority a little more. Possessed by the king, the governor, the feudal lord, down even to mom and dad. We know from experience, do we not, that we have certain, we call them basic fundamental inclinations to certain goods. Philosophers argue how many there are. St. Thomas Aquinas basically reduces them to four, but he fudges now and again throughout the Summa and adds a few more, which is fine. But the basic four we kind of know from experience, don't we? That's one of the beauties of Thomistic philosophy and Thomistic theology, is that it's moderate realism. It's looking at the way things are, the way from observation. And so we know that deep down inside of us, we have an inclination to preserve ourselves in existence. And anything that kind of harms that, we kind of react, either with anger or with pain or sorrow. As you know, those of you who are cooks know that if all of a sudden your hand goes over the flame, ouch, and you put stuff on it because you don't want to get it inflamed worse. You don't want to, you don't want to continue the pain so you can do your work. That fundamental inclination to remain ourselves in existence in part is the whole reason why we have bioethics, medical moral theology, why we have studies of what is reasonable in the moral, in the bioethical field, because this desire to remain in existence is so important. That produces the right to life. And you can see why the state has an important role to play in health care, why we have, it can be for better or for worse, morally, as we know. The next fundamental inclination, as you know we all have, is we all have a tremendous desire for family life, for generating our own children, getting married, having babies. But not just simply having babies. Educating them so that they can learn the customs, the laws, the culture of the land, philosophically speaking. And so they learn that by observation, don't they? Their mom and dad, and maybe their older brothers and sisters. There are just certain things you don't do, and there are certain things you do do. And so, mom and dad have to train children to do certain things like tying their shoes, taking care of the bed, cleaning the room, and all those things, which are small. Some of those are small virtues. Some are just simple. It's tying your shoes, hardly a virtue, but it might very well be if you do it with the right motives. Okay. You also have to keep in mind, too, that mom and dad are the first educators of their children, but not exclusively. It's shared by grandparents, uncles, and aunts, siblings, and of course, fortunately or unfortunately, the schools. Starting from kindergarten to postgraduate work. Again, St. Thomas Aquinas maintains that the first part of the child's life, it's important for his existence, is nourishment, nurturing. And that, of course, comes primarily from mom, who, all things being equal in the early stages of history and throughout the early 20th century, when most people lived in small farms, but not exclusively, that came from breastfeeding. And it came from the baby being with the mother, tactily. Day and night, Even when she's working in the fields, there was always some kind of a sling or something that kept the baby with her. And that way the baby felt, in theory, the mother's affectionate love And as the baby grew to be 2 and 3 and 4, that became a kind of propedeutic for why the baby could trust mom when mom would start giving the child orders or requests or corrections. Because if the person who's been feeding you and making you, you're cleaning you and all the rest of it, you have a certain sense of fundamental love for that person. And you normally, with some exceptions, you want to please that person. And that becomes mom's job. And so as mom starts to inculcate certain principles of life, so the child is more apt to take those in because the boy, the girl, trusts mom. And to a certain extent, dad too, if the dad takes an interest and shows affection too. Just ordinary affection. You don't have to have a PhD for this, as you probably know. And also, by the time the child is 5 or 6 or 7 or any of those years, it begins to feel its own goodness. It feels its goodness because it's mirrored in the fact that mom and dad are pleased that I exist. And they're pleased that I have value. They're pleased. Kid wouldn't put it in that language, I know. We're pleased, and so I feel a certain goodness about myself. That's very, very, very important. It prevents neuroses in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. It prevents depressions later on. Likewise, at a certain age, dad has to kind of take over, according to St. Thomas Aquinas now. Culturally, it doesn't always happen. According to Thomas, it's dad who must try then to teach fundamental morals, fundamental theology, fundamental all kinds of stuff, the job, how to work, how to do things, etc., etc., etc. Kind of helps us appreciate St. Joseph's role in the Holy Family. This is a sidebar. Because you know, if you look carefully at the Lord Jesus in his adult years that we know of, and we only have sketches really, as John reminds us, he could have written volumes and filled a room like this full of what Jesus actually said and did, so we just got little hints. But you can see that Jesus really, really acts very much like a male should act. He's got a masculine character about him that's strong, forthright, not afraid, not a wimp. And one would presume that he got a lot of that from Joseph. In fact, we learned a lot about Joseph by looking at Jesus in many ways. I know it's more common to think about Mary's influence on Jesus, and certainly she did have an influence, no doubt about it. But we neglect to think that, you know, if he was 7 or 8, he had to learn how to read from Jesus. He had to learn how to sing from Jesus. He had to learn how to be a carpenter's son. He had to learn how to carpentry, you know. And so that would mean that, and he had to learn also how to be a man in a Jewish society. And so that Joseph would kind of, teach him these things, not with a lot of reasoning processes, those that had to take place, but just watching him act. He would kind of pick it up on the fly. Much like novices have to learn a lot of things just by osmosis. You can read a constitution till you're blue in the face. You can read a rule. You can do all the external things. But eventually you kind of absorb things by just living the life with others. And you kind of pick up signals, non-conceptual signals perhaps, how you go about becoming, well, in our case, how you go about becoming a saint in our particular unique charismatic communities, because we all have different charisms, of course. Next, the next fundamental inclination, of course, is the desire to communicate with other people. and to share our thoughts and ideas. And that's why we say in marriage, the first communicators are mom and dad to each other as husband and wife, where they express their trials, their joys, their difficulties, their corrections, their upsets, all of the above. And that requires a lot of time, effort. And the theologians following the council try to put that all into self-gift, part of self-gift. And where there's a tremendous communion going on, then the practice, this is a sidebar in a way, where that goes on, it's much easier for natural family planning to go on. Because the man learns more and more about his wife's body, she learns more and more about his psychology, they make sacrifices together. And it's meant to help the family grow in virtue, if people are thinking along these lines. Strengthens family life. Strengthens the children you already have, let alone, you know, having more or having fewer, whatever. That's another course. But you get the idea that a lot of family life comes down to communication. Well, if that's true on the community level, then it's got to also be an interest in the village, in the city, in the state. That's why we become interested in politics, elections, because we want to see our representatives reflect our fundamental values as human beings, as well as Catholic Christians. But, you know, again, abstracting from the faith, even just simply as a human being. You know, we want to see them reflect, we hope, good, solid ideas and ideals. From this, of course, emerges the whole spirit of being social, the whole teaching of the church about the poor, the sick, the lonely, economy, you name it. All that goes on into the church's teachings here reflect that important third inclination of social teaching of the church. In fact, we can say that our communities are also an outburst, not an outburst, a flow from that natural inclination to form community. Again, as a sidebar theologically, and that's why the church tells us in that wonderful document on community life, I forgot the Latin now, fraternal life, it teaches us that the first apostolate is the community. You know? And of course, we already know from our common understanding of things that charity begins at home. And then we have to add, but it doesn't end there. Okay, and that's true with the family. The family itself, going back to the family, is a little community, and it too has to develop bonds with other families. That's why when somebody moves into the neighborhood, generally, other people come and give a little gift, or welcome to the home, or welcome to the block, and all the rest of it. Usually, not always. You can see that quite these three fundamental inclinations imply that we're all exceedingly needy people in the best sense of the word. We can't do everything on our own. We're in constant need of others in a way. That's why anytime any of us does anything of importance in the life of the church, whether it's first grade teacher or a mother provincial or a mother general, all that we do, we owe it to the people who belong to the community. Everybody has had something to do with our lives in some way. everybody. We owe great gratitude to everybody that has helped, shaped us, formed us, informed us. Why is that's why, again, we're by nature social beings. And then the next inclination that we have is the inclination to want to know the truth of reality. What does that mean? We want to know causes, causes of effects, causes of consequences. And eventually, we want to know the prime cause. Now, Aristotle and company didn't understand why human beings didn't achieve their ultimate happiness, because it wasn't revealed to them that our ultimate happiness is meant to be the beatific vision. And Aristotle was puzzled that even as a person started to contemplate and grow in virtue and all the rest of it, which was done by very few, I might add, yet everybody died. And that didn't make sense to Aristotle, and he couldn't figure it out. Of course, we know from faith now, not from reason, that that's an effect of original sin, which he didn't know. So we can also say that we have a certain fundamental inclinations to the virtues, too. As St. Thomas would teach that, St. Bonaventure would teach that. We kind of have within us the desire to be just, chaste, courageous, prudent. We don't live up to that desire quite often on the natural level and the supernatural level too. We also have within us, as we know from experience, inclination to want to have our feelings kind of in sync with our understanding. Even the early philosophers thought of that, although some of them thought they ought to be suppressed, they ought to be pushed aside. We should just live exclusively by the intellect and the will. But other thinkers thought, and still do, that these emotions are good, they're part of our being, and so they want to be exercised reasonably, or not. They want to be experienced reasonably and want to be part of human acts. And again, as we know from experience, if you've ever taught high school, they're like teenagers. You know, they want to do it in their own thing, you know, and then you have to kind of whip them into shape. And that's not easy, of course, but in our case, we're not trying to whip our feelings into shape. As we know theologically, we're trying to flood them with reason and faith. Now, in order for us to achieve a modicum, naturally speaking, of virtue, as I said, and as I'm just imitating the philosophers of the ancients, you need ideals, culture, you need a state that also believes in this, and you need other families, your own family, broadly speaking. And so as you grow from being a child to a teenager, eventually to a mature young adult, a mature young adult, not an adolescent young adult, you see, you've absorbed a whole host of insights and controls, masteries over your feelings, your will, your intellect. This is the ideal. This is what the society is meant to do. And so power, authority, is not per se evil, is not meant to harm you. On the contrary, it's meant to help shape you by good, solid laws that enable you to cooperate with others and not harm others. Can you imagine if there were no laws of the land for driving? We'd bump into one another and die. if there were no laws concerning thievery and all the rest of it, you see. This begins then to help us appreciate and understand the Old Testament and the New Testament, because there we find divine precepts, divine laws, not for their own sake. We also find in the Old Testament Yahweh's demands for obedience to him, even in odd things now and again. And also in the New Testament, we find Jesus, who was obedient even unto death. Huh? Obedient to his heavenly Father, but also obedient to the laws of the land, and also obedient to Mary and Joseph. Now we're ready to begin going into a little deeper the theology of obedience once we've seen the natural order. More coming up. Now, questions, please. Arguments, disagreements. Father, you're absolutely wrong. Sister has a microphone back there, so you won't be happy, and I'll hear everything you say. Because if you don't ask me any questions, then I'll ask you some questions. Like the professor that I am. Or I have to embarrass the students. Ah, sister, she's number one.
Could you repeat the fourth inclination one more time, the inclination to know truth?
Absolutely not. I don't obey anybody. Fundamental inclination to want to remain in existence. Fundamental inclination to want to generate family life and all that that means. Fundamental inclination to communicate and be in a community and socialize. Dependency upon all kinds of people. Fundamental inclination to knowing and loving the truth, which includes a kind of a desire for God, or others would distinguish, say that's a separate inclination. And then I added a few more. St. Thomas adds another one, inclination to virtue, germs of virtue we have within us. I don't know. And then, of course, there's the other problem with that. Those are the good ones. And see, if you understand sin correctly, sin is always an undermining of the good of those inclinations. Always attacking the good of those inclinations. Always maiming the good of those inclinations directly for one's own personal gain and purpose, whatever they are. So you can establish all of your moral teaching precisely on those inclinations. Understanding that when you attack them in some way, and that's why you have divine precepts, because those divine precepts are showing up those inclinations, if you recall the Ten Commandments. Okay? Helpful? Good. Sister.
Ta-da. I haven't fully formulated the question, but I was afraid I would lose the opportunity if I waited too long to ask it.
Oh, go ahead, Farah. In my class, in my classroom, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Because it's always a kernel of truth.
I might be the first. Are you basically saying that naturally speaking, the human being is called to obedience for the good of society?
And the good of person, and the good of family, and the good of...
How is naturally speaking... And I know you spent 45 minutes telling us this. So.
That's all right. It's all right. I'm far away, far away.
It's very easy to see, naturally speaking, that obedience is called for the good of society. Mm-hmm. And how is that obedience called for the good of the person?
Because the person is made to cooperate and collaborate with society, with the family, with the community at large, and the communities that he belongs to. Like, for example, if I belong to, say, the natural society of chess players, then I have to kind of cooperate with the bylaws of that. Go ahead.
But the proof that I have been created to cooperate with others mm-hmm. rests on Thomas.
Experience. Forget about Thomas. Well, it's not an appeal to authority. It's just look at reality.
And this looking is at reality, I can see that I have been called to work, to live, to cooperate with others.
And cooperation means there are some people that are brilliant at producing order in a society, and they write good, solid laws. And that some people don't have that gift. They have other gifts. They know how to cooperate and collaborate. Okay? All right?
Thank you, Father.
Okay. Another flipper. This sister will be next, too, after this sister will be next after her. Okay?
Father, I was intrigued by that idea of the trust that is fostered, for example, the mother breastfeeding and nurturing the child, and just even that the whole feeding thing, and that trust is the basis for obedience.
Not the basis, but the propaedeutic, the preamble, the beginning. Because if you don't have trust, why should you obey anybody?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of our problem in our society today.
Exactly. That's kind of where I'm getting to. I guess I'm not sure if it's a question. It just seems that, is that perhaps part of the problem with obedience is in all of us when we struggle mm-hmm. with that is mm-hmm, mm-hmm, trust mm-hmm. and...
Oh, yeah, sure. Especially if you were not raised in a family that produced this sort of sense of communication and trust, etc., and God still calls you to the religious life. So when a command comes your way that rankles, you know, it's going to be a hard rankling rather than a light rankling, you know. And you're going to, that's part of our punishment due to sin, in a way. We just have to endure it and get over it. And then if you've had a solid, family life, it's much easier. But then on the other hand, God calls the weak to confound the strong. And he has to call people that are living in this crazy society so that they can minister to that crazy society. Hmm? Okay? Sister here, you're going to get a microphone all to your own.
Father, just right near the end here, I began to think, based on what you were saying about the self, the effects of original sin in us that turn us toward ourselves. I hadn't thought very much at all that there would be within us, I mean, we know that the war is there, of the battle between self and then the good of the other, and I'm just... kind of fascinated by, as you spoke about sin as a direct undermining of every one of the goods contained mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. these four inclinations. And I guess what I'm not expressing clearly is this wonderment about what was so evident, because it's innate in us, which is this tendency toward God, which would lead you to go away from yourself, but yet stuck with concupiscence, mm-hmm. sort of like the battle wages on. But I mean, to think that Socrates and Aristotle and these people already were somehow participating in what God placed within them, I guess you could say, because it's how God made us. I'm not sure I've really formulated a question here, but it's mm-hmm. sort of like musings on Genesis, you might say, and what happened in the garden mm-hmm. and what you've been telling us.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, if Aristotle had known about the fall, again, he would have written a different book or two, you know. And if most of us could think more deeply about the fall, too, because these are disordered inclinations. I just talked about the ordered ones from nature. These are the disordered ones that flow from, as a consequence of inheriting original sin. And then, of course, if you go further, They get worse as we commit personal sin, as you know. You know, they get worse and worse and worse and worse. And of course, the grace can sometimes, often overcomes nature, but still there's that stuff that the dregs, the residue of sin that remains with it. Again, Aristotle wouldn't have known anything about this sort of thing. And that's life.
Sister.
This may be an invitation to another conference. I'm not sure.
Oh, it's okay.
But, you know, you mentioned the crazy society, and this is all very well ordered. But I guess my question is, when you're laying the human foundations for obedience, and you've mm-hmm. got young people who are coming into religious life who come from a disordered family, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. pretty much every family, not everybody, but mm-hmm, there's an awful mm-hmm. lot of them out there. Mm-hmm. How do you remedy, shore up, fix, assist, form, when they haven't had that foundation? You know, mm-hmm. when you talk about the mother and you talk about the being with, and then you talk about the father coming in and doing the, you mm-hmm. know, the moral instruction, and they've never had that. Mm-hmm. And they're coming from a culture that preaches liberty, mm-hmm. and you start to talk about things like this, they have no clue. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. help.
In 3 minutes or less. I like questions like that. Oh, mamma mia. Well, first of all, they may not have a calling, but they may have a calling to religious life, but they may be experiencing a calling to repentance. And the work that you do with them at the end of the year or two, or three, or four, may indicate you don't belong. But you do belong now in a better way, we hope, as a potential mom, or a single person, or what have you in the world. So you don't worry about the consequence of whether they're going to make it to profession or not. You're helping them grow in perfection, and maybe they're minus 10. Maybe at the end of the year, they're minus 4. But they don't have enough to come to 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, using an analogy. You can't replace mom and dad, no. But you can be kind and helpful and tolerant, you know, very tolerant of things, and letting certain things, and knowing how to choose your battles. And then you've got to know what's the difference between what's essential and what's merely accidental, and work on the essentials. Because it's far worse than this. That's just the natural problem. Then most of these people don't know any Catholic teaching either. And that's even worse, a situation. Yet, they somehow God is knocking on their heart, and you've got to respect that knock. I mean, I was a terrible novice myself. I was horrible. I hated every minute of it. And yet I knew in my heart of hearts God wanted me to be a Dominican. I didn't know I was going to be a priest. That was far from my mind, but I knew I had to be a Dominican. That was it. So all of these things, it takes time and patience and effort. And if a person's gone through the regular, looking at the person before they even walk in the front door, well, there's a chance that something might happen here. And, of course, grace is more powerful than nature. And I'm not saying that God is going to do exceptional, extraordinary things with every single human being. No, but he might do more than we realize. I mean, look at some of our awful saints who were horrible people before they became saintly, And then one day, all of a sudden they make a shift. Look at Brother Charles Foucault. Ugh. Look at St. Augustine, for heaven's sake. And they're probably, look at Mary Magdalene, Good grief. So we can also keep trusting in grace, and maybe at the end of the year, if these four or five or six we may have, then we might have to send them away. Well, look, you've grown in virtue. You've grown in virtue. Well, You laugh, but it's true. It's true. Just don't, you know, drink too much wine is the only thing, you know. Don't eat four desserts when you're frustrated, you know. Just eat one and a half.
Father, you said that, just want to make sure, there's an inclination to have our feelings in sync with our our will or with our faith and reason?
Yes, the way we would express, I mean, I was just teasing a little bit there in the theology, because I was asked to do something philosophically as well as theologically, though I prefer theology, but I know philosophy. So anyway, all of our human acts should flow from right reason, and that means following the natural law. That means following the divine precepts that we know about, and there are more than 10 commandments. They're positive and negative ones. And positive precepts we should choose, negative precepts things we should avoid. So we've got faith, reason, and then, as I'll say in my next conference, if I remember it, following the inspirations of the Holy Spirit. So there are basically three important qualities that have to go into a moral act. For most of us, it'll be reason and faith. And as you grow in the spiritual life, and this is something I hope I can remember to talk about, you also have to learn to live by the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit. And as I will say again, the whole purpose, not the whole purpose, but part of the purpose of the virtuous life is to dispose us to heroic virtue. I'll explain what that means. That's part of our call. That's part of obedience. You and I may never get there, but we've got to be open to it. We may not become the giant St. Catherine of Siena's or the giant St. Teresa of Avila's or the little flower giant, all these female saints that are ballooning all over the place, and the male saints too. We may never get there, but we'll aim for there. That's all God asks. He only asks that we aim for perfection, not that we be perfect here and now. Okay. Maybe we better take a break, or should we go on? I can go on forever. You know? Go ahead. We'll go forever. Go ahead. You just won't have any cookies or something. No more breaks.
My question has to do with the emotions or the passions. And would you explain the difference between suppressing your emotions and controlling them and how that would look on a practical level? And maybe just give an example of an emotion and how... what you would be seeing if someone suppressed it, if they controlled it, and obviously
Okay. You got an hour or two? Yeah. You want to take a whole course here. Well, let's do it as simply as we can so you can at least get a cup of coffee or something here. I've insulted you. Your reaction? But I'm supposed to be a holy religious. I'm not supposed to have these feelings. I'm not going to have these feelings. I didn't have these feelings. That's repression. That's what you want to avoid. I'm a holy religious. I can't possibly be tempted against chastity. Absolutely not. I can't possibly be tempted to want to shoot my superior. No. No. That's not me. That's somebody else. No. Repression. It's called denial. Not self-denial, but it's denial. That's repression. On the other hand, when you have any kind of temptation to want to shoot your superiors or to want to get rid of any temptation, then you have to learn to channel the energy in different ways. It's different for sins against, when you've been treated unjustly is one way. When you have sexual temptations, it's another way. When you're tempted to want to eat more is another way. When you're tempted to want to steal something, that's another way. I mean, little variations in how you deal with it, but you never deny that you've been tempted. Sometimes people claim that temptations are sins. Well, they're not, strictly speaking, formal sins. St. Thomas and St. Augustine calls them venial sins, but we have to call that analogously. It's just sort of the gunk that's coming from, like the oil comes from the bleeder, it just sort of pops in, you know. I mean, if you're really, 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 really holy, well, you kind of will instantly act. Now, for example, John Paul II was, you know, obviously a saint. And so when a door was shut on his hand, unlike myself, he said, "Thank you, Jesus." I wouldn't be saying that. Because I'm not there yet. Okay. Let's take a break. Our help is in the name of the Lord.